Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the breaking news from ABC News that the special counsel, Robert Mueller, has been questioning Trump's former lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, extensively in interviews in Washington, D.C. and New York, and that Mueller has primarily been focusing on Trump's dealings with Russia. Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, joins us to discuss how Mueller has been wary of dealing with Cohen's lawyer, Lenny Davis, since Davis represents prominent Russian oligarchs and organized crime figures. But apparently Cohen's alleged visit to Prague to pay off Russian hackers involved in meddling in the 2016 campaign, which was first noted in the Steele dossier, has been part of the discussions. And since Cohen himself has ties to Russian and Ukrainian gangsters that preceded Trump's ties to the Russian and Ukrainian mob, and Cohen first met Trump when he bought condos in Trump properties for his Russian and Ukrainian criminal clients, the combination of what Cohen knows about who funded the Trump Organization, together with what the chief financial officer of the Trump Organization knows and is telling Mueller, could prove fatal to Trump. Then with today's email from the lawyers for Kavanaugh's accuser to the Senate Judiciary Committee stating that Christine Blasey Ford, quote, would be prepared to testify next week if the senators offered her terms that are fair and which ensure her safety. We will speak with Mike Zabrensky, chief counsel at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. He was Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Obama administration working on judicial nominations for the Department of Justice and joins us to discuss his article at Medium, Judicial Nominees Background Investigations, Fact versus Fiction, and how flimsy and fatuous Trump's and the Republicans' excuses are for why the FBI can't do a quick investigation of Dr. Ford's charges against Kavanaugh. Then finally, we will speak with Daniel Bessner, a professor in American Foreign Policy at the University of Washington's Henry M. Jackson School of International Studies, who has an article at the New York Times, What Does Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez Think About the South China Sea? The Rising Left Needs More Foreign Policy. Here's how it can start. We'll discuss the sweet spot in American politics the left has yet to discover, in which you can be an idealist on domestic issues while being a realist on foreign policy. And joining us now is Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Scott. And ABC News is reporting today that Michael Cohen has been spending a lot of time with the Mueller team and has been testifying to them about, well, we don't quite know, but we know that the interviews with Cohen took place in Washington, D.C. and New York City, and they were attended in part by prosecutors from the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York. So, obviously, they're making a big deal of this on cable news. Is it a big deal?
It might be a big deal. I guess a couple of observations we can throw out there. We know that for quite some period of time, Robert Mueller and his team were really not terribly interested in talking to Michael Cohen. And we know that there were two reasons for that. One is that Lanny Davis was out there dangling information about the Veselnitskaya meeting in Trump Tower, saying that Cohen was going to be able to provide a great deal of additional information about that. And their attitude was that they just weren't particularly interested in that information. They felt that they had a firm grip on the facts of what had transpired. And the second really had to do with Lanny Davis himself. That is, Lanny Davis is the attorney for Dmitry Firtash, a very powerful post-Soviet oligarch, very closely connected to Semyon Mogilevich, organized crime head in Russia. And it's through that link, it appears, he was introduced to Cohen. And Firtash is so deeply tied up in the Russiagate investigation that I think the assumption on the part of the investigators was it'd be impossible for Lanny Davis himself to broker and set up a proffer and deal for Cohen that involved useful information on the Russia dealings. So that's happened in the past. Now, knowing that there's been a meeting more than 10 hours in two different locations suggests that they found some way to get over both of those issues. So it suggests as to the substance that there is quite a bit of real substance being offered to them, because it doesn't take long to just say, no, I never had any meetings. This indicates pretty clearly that there are, you know, there's detailed information being given about many meetings, but we have no information at this point of the substance of what's happened. I think we do know, however, that he would want a deal, a cooperating agreement with Mueller, and to do that, he's got to make a proffer that is sufficiently useful and credible to the prosecutors for them to agree to that. So clearly, that's what's in the making here.
So we're going well beyond paying off porn stars, because obviously the fact that Cohen shows up in the Steele dossier as having gone to a meeting in Prague with a bunch of Russians to actually pay these Russian trolls for the cyber meddling in the 2016 election. So if that's the case, that's a huge deal if that's the case, right?
That's exactly right. So, I think Mueller had drawn a line very early on, making it extremely clear that he was not involved in and was not interested in everything to do with payment to porn stars. That was beyond his remit. I mean, I think he could have aggressively taken the position that that was within it. But I think tactically, he's taken the position that he wants the core matters related to Russia and these issues relating dealing with porn stars and collaborating with the National Enquirer and so forth, that this is going to be handled by the Southern District of New York. So, of course, we also have in these reports a notation the Southern District of New York is also involved. And I think that shows his style of operation. So the work that they have done is being leveraged. And it's clear that Southern District and Mueller and his team are working hand in glove on these things. So they're sharing information. But they're pursuing different agendas. But in the ultimate, in the end, if a cooperating witness agreement is reached, that's likely to be an agreement that's reached by both. So it would be Mueller and it would be the Southern District.
And again, I'm speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. So to the extent to which the Southern District of New York have been involved in these negotiations along with the Mueller team with Michael Cohen, they're also, along with the porn star stuff, they're looking into the Trump family charity and the Trump organization itself. Obviously, Barbara Underwood, the Attorney General, is looking into that in New York. And of course, Cohen would be very helpful in that regard. But in terms of the real smoking gun stuff that Cohen could provide Mueller with, at least what we know, in regard to the alleged meeting in Prague with the Russian trolls and hackers are paying them off to interfere in the 2016 elections. That's pretty huge. There's some dispute about whether that meeting happened. Peter Stone at McClatchy has said that indeed the meeting did take place and that they found evidence that Cohen had gone to Prague, even though he said he hadn't, but he apparently crossed the border from Austria or Germany. So that's been disputed by Lanny Davis, his current lawyer, Cohen's current lawyer, who said it never took place at all. Lanny Davis, as you mentioned, has been representing some of the worst members of the Russian organized crime oligarchs. So I'm not entirely convinced he has a lot of credibility. So where would you come down on this?
Well, I think it's clear that he is being interrogated about his movements in Europe, in particular, in the course of the end of 2015 and 2016, and also his movements and activities in connection with the Trump Tower Moscow project. Prague is a part of this, and I know McClatchy has said that they have confirming evidence. I've talked to people in German intelligence who also have a very high level of confidence that Cohen was in Prague. Then he crossed over from the German side of the frontier. So it seems that there's quite a bit pointing to that. On the other hand, I would say And then we have Lanny Davis saying it's reported 14 times and the SEAL dossier that he was in Prague and it's wrong 14 times. I would say don't be so focused on the Prague meeting, because there are allegations out there that have been around for some time tying him to six different meetings with Russian intelligence figures in Europe over that period of time. Prague is one of the six, and I'm sure what's going on now is that he is being interrogated at length about each of these suspected meetings. And I think the Mueller team will have access to the full panoply of data that it's been collected by U.S. intelligence and also by European intelligence organizations, and they will be using that to fact-check what he's telling them and to make an assessment of whether he's being forthcoming and candid in his statements. So if he continues to deny he was at certain locations and had certain meetings when they have evidence showing that he was, that would be very bad news for him, because I think one thing we've seen in the past is that they go after and crack down much more harshly on people who make a proffer to them and lie in the course of the proffer. That's a very bad idea.
Well, we know that Michael Cohen is desperate because, you know, he was worth several million dollars, and now he's launched an online GoFundMe fundraising effort to pay his skyrocketing legal bills. So he's definitely, you know, it's a question of whether he really is desperate, which he clearly is, and has something real to offer, or just wants to inflate his value because of his mounting financial problems. But what about this meeting that took place, this lunch meeting with a Ukrainian, pro-Russian Ukrainian politician 1 week after Trump took office? Apparently they discussed some kind of peace deal that was favorable to Putin that Cohen was suggesting that he could somehow get the White House to agree to.
Yes, and individuals close to Dmitry Firtash were involved in that effort as well.
That was clearly
an effort to advance the interests of the Kremlin, not the interests of Ukraine, as part of a process. So I'm sure that he's being interrogated about that. There's also information floating around that he was paid following the election indirectly by a number of foreign political leaders, and that included, political leaders in Ukraine. I'm sure he's being interrogated about all of that, because one of the things they're doing is trying to follow the flow of cash from government sources generally, but especially government sources in the former Soviet Union, into the coffers of Trump, or the use of cash for the benefit of Trump. And if you look at the arrangement he had with Trump, he was advancing funds to do things on Trump's behalf and then seeking to recapture it at the end. So there's quite a bit of commingling going on, and it seems that fees and sums he was receiving were being used to advance the personal or private interests of Trump. So all that is going to figure in intense questioning. I have no doubt about that.
So would this be a case where, in the Craig Unger book, House of Trump, House of Putin, it makes it pretty clear that Trump has been on the Russian payroll, both gangsters, oligarchs, and intelligence people on the Russian side. It could have been, you know, starting as early as 1984, certainly in 1987, the visit to Moscow is considered pretty suspicious in Craig Unger's book. So is it possible that the allegations in that book, which are pretty hair-raising, essentially making the case that Trump became the kind of conduit for dirty Russian money when the Soviet Union collapsed and through the post-Soviet period up till the present? And they've been money laundering through buying condos in Trump properties. If they've already got the CFO, the chief financial officer of the Trump, he's able to, apparently he probably has the books. Would Cohen be useful in buttressing whatever's in those books?
Absolutely. In fact, you have to go back and remember who Cohen is how he rose and how he came to the attention of Trump. So Cohen's uncle is the man who owned and operated the Caribe Social Club, which was effectively the headquarters of the Russian mob in New York for many years. So, and Michael Cohen grew up there, knew by name and knew physically pretty much all the leadership of the Russian mob. That's from his days in high school and college, and continued to deal with him on a business basis. This is before he knew Trump. And then his introduction to Trump comes by brokering the purchase of a number of units in a Trump building for Russian mobsters. And that's Russian mobsters in the United States and Russian mobsters in Russia and Ukraine. And that was remarked upon. That's how he got Trump's attention and how he worked his way into the family. So he was pretty much from the beginning of his career, certainly his career with the Trump Organization, he was a major conduit for dark Russian money coming into the Trump Organization. And later on, he had a special role within the Trump Organization and dealing with Russian funders, in particular Russian mobsters. But also, if we come right up to the time of the campaign, 2015, 2016, Trump, of course, saying during the campaign he had no business dealings with Russia. Well, that was not true. I mean, we now know that he was feverishly pursuing a Trump Tower Moscow project. And in doing that, there were dealings with major Russian banks, including two Russian banks that are actually controlled by the Kremlin, with their finance agencies of the Kremlin, Veneshekonom and Veneshtorg Bank. You know, Michael Cohen certainly knows about all those dealings and the funding and what happened and didn't happen. I'm sure he would be questioned at length about all of that now.
Well, Scott Horton, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My great pleasure.
Thanks again, Scott. And I've been speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back joined by a former Deputy Assistant Attorney General who was in charge of judicial nominations for the Justice Department on the flimsy and fatuous excuses Trump and the Republicans are offering for why the FBI can't do a quick investigation of Dr. Ford's charges against Kavanaugh. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mike Dubensky, who is chief counsel at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. During the Obama administration, he was deputy assistant attorney general and worked on judicial nominations for the Department of Justice, and he has an article at Medium, Judicial Nominee Background Investigations, Fact versus Fiction. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Dubensky.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you, Mike. And there's been a development in this sort of standoff between the accuser of Judge Kavanaugh, Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, and the Senate Judiciary Committee. Today, Professor Ford's lawyers sent an email to the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I'll just quickly read it. I would like to set up a call with you later today to discuss the conditions under which Dr. Christine Blasey Ford would be prepared to testify next week. As you are aware, she has been receiving death threats, which have been reported to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and she and her family have been forced out of their home. She wishes to testify, provided we can agree on terms that are fair and which ensure her safety. A hearing on Monday is not possible, and the committee's insistence that it occur then is arbitrary in any event. Dr. Ford has asked me to let you know that she appreciates the various options you have suggested. Her strong preference continues to be for the Senate Judiciary Committee to allow for a full investigation prior to her testimony. So that's the latest, Mike. How do you think this thing has gone so far and where it's heading? My sense is that maybe the lawyers for Dr. Ford have somewhat overplayed their hand. My understanding of the Senate and its jealously guarded prerogatives, it's not called the world's most exclusive club for nothing. So they seem to have gotten offended by some of the – they managed to get some of their senators who were sympathetic, like Jeff Flake and Senator Corker, to switch back to the rest of the Republicans who are pretty hard-nosed about this. So where do we stand in your mind?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent summary of where things stand. You're right. I mean, there's only a handful of senators who have not divulged their decision on Judge Kavanaugh's nomination, and so that is the main audience that is at issue at this point in the nomination process. And how those senators, that handful of senators, how they react to the dynamics of Dr. Blasey Ford's allegations and the way she's treated, you know, as a sexual assault survivor, we hope that they would have the proper level of respect that should be shown to someone who has gone through the experience that she has. But it does seem to be an ever-changing dynamic almost on a daily basis. And, you know, it sounds as if that there's a good chance that there will be a hearing next week. Dr. Blasey Ford has said Monday is not a viable day for her. And at this point, we're waiting for Chairman Grassley to respond as to whether he's willing to make an accommodation and have the hearing later in the week. It certainly seems like he should do that. I mean, there's nothing that requires him to go forward on Monday. You know, the process has been driven all along by an irrational desire on the part of the Republican Party to just steamroll Judge Kavanaugh's nomination through the process, and they have cut corner after corner in trying to achieve that goal of getting him confirmed before the Democrats have a chance to evaluate his background and his records from his job in the Bush White House. You know, we're not talking about that issue right now because of the new sexual assault allegations that are dominating the media coverage. But, you know, we shouldn't forget that there have been a number of different points of this process where the Republicans have not made available the vast majority, over 90% of Kavanaugh's White House records have not been made available to the Democrats and to the American people to see what Judge Kavanaugh was involved in when he worked in the Bush White House in the early 2000s.
But surely you have to add to this, or at least put it in context, Mike Zabrinsky, and that is that the Republicans have played hardball in a way that's pretty breathtaking, denying Obama's nominee for the Supreme Court even a hearing. And all the while, when Obama was in the White House, they slow-walked and blocked judicial nominations to the point where there was a major backlog, which now Trump is able to fill. So my question to you would be, why should we expect them to be any different? They've always been hard-nosed, if not thuggish, in their attitude.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good question. And, you know, I think we should expect them to do the right thing when the stakes are as high as they are, even if they have not done the right thing in the past. And, you know, the examples you point to are very strong evidence of how they tend to bring, you know, they bring a gun to a knife fight all the time. and it's resulted in their goal. You know, their goal is to pack the federal courts with judges who are not going to be neutral and fair-minded, but who are going to have a very conservative ideological agenda. But you know, it seems like the American people are catching on to this, and the public opinion polling shows President Trump with very low favorability ratings right now, and in congressional polling, you know, there are increasing majorities who favor electing Democrats over Republicans in the next election, in the midterm election that's coming up, and I think that is because Republicans have overplayed their hand in area after area, and I think this is something that the American people are going to say enough is enough.
Well, the one person who's been behaving uncharacteristically, when I just suggested that the Republicans have been pretty hard-nosed all along, in fact, they've been extraordinarily so, I would not expect them to change their tune, even though there are a couple of outliers like Senator Flake and Senator Corker. But the one person who seems to be changing his tune somewhat is President Trump himself. He's not going after Professor Ford in his usual kind of reflexive trashing anybody that criticizes him or disagrees with him. So he's obviously being advised to be restrained. But his position, which is shared by the Republicans, that somehow or other you can't have an FBI investigation, just seems so totally absurd. And you can't divorce that president's statements from what he's been saying about the FBI itself. He's been saying the most outrageous things about the FBI, that they're corrupt. He's been using that term. At the same time saying, oh, they can't do this, background check. One former member of the FBI on television the other night said, wait a minute, there's three words, FBI. The third word, I, stands for investigations. So what do you make of that thin excuse they're putting forth?
Yeah, I mean, that is absolutely correct. I mean, the president seems to have great hostility towards the work of the FBI, you know, which traditionally is a conservative law enforcement agency. And you know, we're at a point that is pretty hard to believe in American history where you have a sitting Republican president taking, you know, almost daily pot shots at the premier federal law enforcement agency, as well as the attorney general. I mean, you know, look at what he said yesterday about Attorney General Sessions. I mean, you know, I work for a nonprofit organization that advances civil rights, and you can imagine that we are not big fans of the work of Attorney General Sessions and his priorities. But you know, people like us are in the position of defending this Attorney General, at least to the extent that he get to keep his job and not be fired because he, you know, in one of the few independent decisions of his career, he decided to recuse himself from the Russia investigation. But it is, you know, it's pretty astonishing that he, his hostility to the FBI, you know, continues. I think you're right. This is part of that hostility that we're seeing extended to the Kavanaugh process. Having said that, I also want to point out that the Republican majority in the Senate and Chairman Grassley of the Senate Judiciary Committee, he is the leader at this point of the process because he runs the Judiciary Committee. He could ask the White House to initiate an FBI investigation. So while it is technically true that only the White House and the Justice Department can initiate an FBI investigation into a judicial nominee, if Senator Grassley asked them to do that, they would almost certainly go ahead and ask the FBI to do an investigation of Dr. Blasey Ford's allegations. So I do think that you have to point the finger not only at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, but also to Capitol Hill.
And again, I'm speaking with Mike Zabrinsky, who is chief counsel at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. During the Obama administration, he was deputy assistant attorney general and worked on judicial nominations for the Department of Justice. And he has an article at Medium, Judicial Nominee Background Investigations, Fact versus Fiction. So if this is a game that's being played here and the Republicans are accusing the Democrats of trying to run out the clock, and on the other hand, the Republicans are clearly rushing this thing through, one, they, I think they want a trophy for their constituents to vote for them as an achievement. I think Trump himself desperately needs a win. So is there any sense then that we will have a compromise? I mean, it seems like, as I mentioned earlier, I thought maybe the lawyers for Professor Ford maybe overplayed their hand. Now they're to some extent trying to back down, at least get her before the committee under some conditions. What is happening to her is grossly unfair because she's really there alone without having had an investigation, because there are many people involved in this incident or this alleged incident that would be able to be interviewed. So walk us through, or at least explain to us why, and you've done this, of course, in your piece, Fact versus Fiction, why this is so fatuous, this claim that you can't invest, the FBI can't investigate it.
Yeah, sure. I think there's been a lot of attention that has been paid to the Anita Hill situation with Clarence Thomas in 1991. You know, that certainly is a very similar situation with, you know, a late breaking development with Anita Hill's allegations involving Clarence Thomas, and we obviously know how that played out. But it's a good analogy, not only because of the nature of the allegations, but also because of the process. As soon as Anita Hill identified herself to the government in 1991 as someone who had been subject to this horrific sexual harassment from Judge Thomas, the FBI launched an investigation at the request of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and so in a sense, Dr. Blasey Ford is being treated even worse than Anita Hill. And we all know how poorly Anita Hill was treated. And so the FBI did an investigation. It only took 3 days. So they were able to do their work quickly. You know, you said that Democrat earlier, you mentioned that, you know, the Republicans are alleging that Democrats are trying to run out the clock here and stalling. But, you know, 3 days or 4 days or 5 days, however long it might take for the FBI to conduct an investigation of the current allegations, you know, that's not a great deal of time. You know, we're not talking about stalling this out for months and months, the way they treated Merrick Garland, as you mentioned, in 2016. You know, we're asking for a basic process that has been followed in the past. And as I mentioned in my piece, this process was also followed with respect to a number of lower court judicial nominees, you know, people that weren't in the headlines and people that, you know, you've never heard of. But, you know, this is the common procedure when there are questions, serious questions that involve a pending nominee. In the past, in my experience during the Obama administration, there was a bipartisan request from the chair and the ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. They would ask us to, the office that I was in, they would ask us to liaison with the FBI and ask the FBI to do a follow-up supplemental investigation. And that's what we would do. And the FBI would come back in a couple of days and they would say, you know, here's the information we gathered. They would type up their summaries and they would submit those summaries of their interviews, of witnesses, and of additional information that they had collected. They would type that up, send it to us in a file, and then we would look at it and then send it to the Senate. And that is what we believe and what many commentators on both sides of the aisle believe should take place right now.
But do you think, or do you know, Mike Zabrinsky, whether or not the FBI is protecting Christine Blasey Ford? She's had death threats. She's had to move out of her home. She's reported these to the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Is she under protection?
I do not know that. Good question. I do not know. I know that, I know what I've read in the media, which is she's, you know, received death threats and she has real fears for her safety. But I don't know what kind of protection she might have.
So it's a bit surreal that she's saying, I'll show up at the hearing, and not on Monday, but on some subsequent day. But again, she said, would be prepared to testify next week if the senators offer terms that are fair and which ensure her safety. So it's pretty strange, isn't it, that she's asking for the minimal, which is to protect her life. She never wanted to go public. That was clear why it took so long to get this information out, because she anticipated what would happen, and it has happened. The worst has happened. So it's a bit surreal, isn't it, on the one hand, to be asking the committee to protect her and have the FBI give her that basic security, at the same time not have the FBI spend a couple of days looking into this matter.
Yes. I mean, the FBI, you know, I think that there are instances in which they are involved with witness protection and security. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if they would be involved with something like this, where you have, you know, allegations made by someone who's not involved in a criminal investigation. You know, no one is calling for a federal criminal investigation of Brett Kavanaugh. This alleged crime took place a long time ago, probably past any kind of federal statute of limitations. And also, when it comes to sexual assaults like this, I mean, these are typically state crimes. I mean, the federal government doesn't, except for like on federal lands and where the federal government has jurisdiction, sort of exclusive jurisdiction, they might be able to bring prosecutions like this. But they are not doing a federal criminal investigation right now. No one is asking them to do that. And so I don't know if the witness protection program would be triggered for a situation like this. I don't think that it would, but I do hope as everyone does that her security and safety come first in whatever transpires after this.
Well, indeed, it would probably be the Capitol Police that would protect her physically at the hearing itself. Mm-hmm. But still, if she's asked the FBI for protection, we don't know where that stands and who's protecting her at the moment, or whether she's just literally hiding, quaking in fear. So I find this whole thing rather disturbing. And I thank you for joining us, Mike Zabrinsky.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Mike Zabrinsky, who's the chief counsel at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. During the Obama administration, he was deputy assistant attorney general and worked on judicial nominations for the Department of Justice. And he has an article at Medium, Judicial Nominee Background Investigations, Fact versus Fiction. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing the sweet spot in American politics the left has yet to discover, in which you can be both an idealist on domestic issues while being a realist on foreign policy. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Daniel Bessner, a professor of American foreign policy at the University of Washington's Henry M. Jackson School of International Studies, and the author of Democracy in Exile, Hand Spy, and The Rise of the Defense Intellectual. He has an article at the New York Times, What Does Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez Think About the South China Sea? The Rising Left Needs More Foreign Policy. Here's How It Can Start. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Bessner.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Daniel. And before we tutor Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, it seems, though, that the entire political landscape has been turned on its head lately. The traditional coal warriors, red baiters, Russian or Soviet haters, I should say, they are now, in many cases, making excuses for Putin and defending Trump against charges that there may be some collusion or conspiracy or certainly something going on which the special prosecutor is looking into. And then on the political left, the traditional critics of the CIA and of U.S. foreign policy are now hoping that the CIA can find the evidence to impeach Trump. So let's start with that. I mean, what's happening there?
Well, I basically think that everybody was so shocked by Trump's victory that we're seeing a lot of it's kind of a liminal period, a period where people don't know quite what to do. And so you're seeing a rearrangement of ideological alignments in real time. So you have, as you said, the Democratic Party supporting the CIA and the FBI on one hand, and the Republican Party sort of elements of Never Trump or Republicans criticizing what is turned out to be a rather traditional Trump foreign policy. And what you see here is that the consensus that has basically guided American foreign policy since the 1940s and especially since the Cold War ended is coming undone. And so you see people don't really know what they're doing and they don't even know what they're supposed to say. And this is the moment that we're in right now.
Well, the only defense that I would offer Trump is that nobody has died on his watch so far, certainly compared to what happened under Obama and particularly under George W. Bush.
Yeah, that might have to be less to do with Donald Trump and more due to his inability to manage the security apparatus of the state. But to be frank, as a historian, I think the truth is we might not actually know what's going on right now. We don't really yet know what the military's been doing abroad. We might find some documents later on that the absence of a leadership figure at the head of this massive military apparatus, this imperial apparatus, has actually let local actors do more than they would have otherwise been able. So I'd say right now it's more of an open question than a settled one.
Well, the way that the president talks about our military is entirely in terms of how much money he's spending on it. And he did that with the Polish president talking about we make the best planes, the best missiles, and we're spending $716 billion. So that seems to be his yardstick is how much you're spending. And he keeps talking about how terrible the military was under Obama. It was all broken down, and now it's we're standing tall with the best planes and missiles. So let's turn then to the article that you have in the New York Times. What does Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez think about the South China Sea? The rising left needs more foreign policy. Here's how it can start. Bernie Sanders actually wrote a piece recently, The New Authoritarian Axis Demands an International Progressive Front. What did you make of that?
I thought it was a very good piece. I think Bernie has, since the 2016 presidential campaign, where he didn't in particular focus on foreign policy, has really made an effort in the last year and especially in the last few months to begin developing a left-wing foreign policy that should he decide to run in 2020 and should he win the nomination and should he beat Trump in the election would be able to serve as a useful starting point going forward. So I think it's a really excellent step that Bernie's been taking and taking foreign policy more seriously and thinking about it in really capacious terms. And in particular, the way that he's been able to connect his domestic critique of inequality with a more international vision, I think has been particularly impressive. So, for example, his mentioning of tax havens is, I think, a really important international issue, but also one with domestic implications where people avoid taxation, and so they're able to increase domestic inequality. So I've been pretty impressed with Bernie's moves recently.
Well, in a curious way, though, of course, I was mentioning the Department of Defense, the Pentagon spending under Trump and how he was boasting about it. But the reality is that in today's world, the Treasury Department actually has probably more powerful tools, the so-called red letter. And that would seem to be in trying to deal with Putin and the kleptocracies around the world that are at war with democracy and undermining it. And that's really the issue of complicity with Trump, the extent to which he is okay with undermining democracy, which he appears to be. And he has certainly showing authoritarian tendencies here at home. But isn't the best way to deal with kleptocrats to expose their ill-gotten gains?
Oh, yes. I think it's definitely important to absolutely expose kleptocrats and their ill-gotten gains, both at home and abroad. But I think it's important to understand Trump, at least in my opinion, as more the apotheosis or apex of trends in American foreign policy, and rather than as a radical departure. Because in my opinion, at least, American foreign policy has been undemocratic for a very long time, particularly since the creation in the 1940s of essentially a set of institutions that were consciously designed to be essentially unaccountable to the public or even to Congress, institutions like the National Security Council or the CIA, or even parastate institutions like think tanks, which exist essentially on government contracts, but which aren't really subject to congressional or public review. So in my opinion, at least, Trump is really the apex of a decades long trend. And what we need to do now going forward is to think about new ways to make American foreign policy making more democratic and to make it more accountable, so that no longer an unelected and unaccountable elite is able to decide totally what America does in the world.
But where do you come out on this canard Trump's using about the deep state? Are you implying in any way what you just said could be described as the deep state?
I wouldn't use those terms necessarily, because in my view, at least, deep state sounds unnecessarily conspiratorial, when in reality, it was a conscious choice that historians have known for a while and have been making clear for a while. In the 1940s, in the face of a perceived existential Soviet threat, a bunch of institutions were created that were intended to allow a democracy, which previously had been viewed as too slow to deal with what were then called totalitarian regimes, had been created to allow a democracy to fight this existential war. So if one wants to call that the deep state, that's one's own opinion, but I just refer to it as what is in fact the American state. And ironically, historically, at least, this is a capital P progressive project, where you would create these elite institutions that would be able to manage this ever more complex world of modernity. Now, of course, in our modern political discourse, that's so degraded, the deep state becomes this conspiratorial thing that everyone's out to get Trump. But I would say that it's pretty clear that within the official structures of the national security establishment, there is significant opposition to Trump. And you see that just with the widespread use of leaking and with the fact that all these newspapers are able to get access to materials that do little but embarrass Trump. And in a good way, Trump should be embarrassed. And there's obviously, I think, an internal state disagreement between the executive and other bodies of the executive, like the FBI and CIA, regarding what America should do abroad.
But when you talk about the Cold War and the Soviet Union, now that was a real enemy. The entire United States, every major city was targeted 24/7. And within 20 minutes of the Russians wiping out the United States would have then retaliated and wiped out Russia. And that was the very surreal reed upon which our defense rested, mutually assured destruction. Somehow we survived that, and there still some of the near misses haven't really been made public, but it's pretty miraculous that we survived it. The point I want to make is that that was a real enemy. They could have destroyed us. Now, since then, since they've collapsed, not that the weapons have gone away, and recently Putin threatened General Mattis, saying that he was prepared to use tactical nuclear weapons in the Baltics. Nevertheless, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, we haven't had any real enemies, nothing like what we had during the Cold War. So can you make a case? What the hell are we spending all this money on?
Oh, I absolutely agree. I think that it's really, you know, the Marxian quote, versus tragedy. Then as far as the United States faces no real threats on its sovereignty from any of the powers that people generally point to, whether it's the People's Republic of China or Russia or North Korea, let alone the Islamic State. And I completely agree. So now it's just you have this institutional inertia where this unipolar moment of the 1990s has basically just continued to exist, even as inequality increases at home and we spend more and we continue to spend more and more on our military. And before we go on, I just want to make the historical point. I think that historians are actually learning that the Soviet Union was not as intent on destroying the United States as American policymakers legitimately believed in the 1940s and 1950s. New documents that have been revealed over the last 10 or 20 years, to my opinion at least, show that the Cold War could have definitely ended in the 1950s, saving not only billions and trillions and quadrillions of dollars, but also millions upon millions of lives. So I think we also need to be careful about saying that the Soviet Union represented a true existential threat. I mean, in a strict sense, it did, in that it did have the capacity for nuclear weapons to destroy the United States, but that diplomacy and in actually engaging with Soviet leaders might have actually ended the Cold War decades earlier than it did.
Well, Eisenhower was poised to do that. He had a very successful visit here in the United States with Khrushchev. The reciprocal visit was arranged. Khrushchev even built a golf course down in Crimea for Ike, and all was set to literally end the Cold War when the U-2 incident happened. And just,
right.
You know, so, and I think in many ways that led Eisenhower to, in his farewell address, to talk about the military-industrial complex and to warn about it. So,
exactly.
But let's turn to your article and the challenge of the American left. I think, obviously, the left in this country is much weaker than most of the other democracies around the world, and there may well be a reason for it that, you know, they're not particularly credible on foreign policy. I don't understand why the left can't discover the sweet spot in American politics. You can be both an idealist on domestic issues at the same time as a realist on foreign policy.
Yes, I think that's true. And I think there's a number of contingent historical reasons for that. I mean, it's important to emphasize the structural reasons for that, that the American state, as it developed and coalesced in the 40s and the 50s, was a place that was absolutely hostile to any sort of counter-hegemonic thought, any sort of thought that criticized the Cold War. So anyone who would have been a left-wing critic was just not allowed to develop his capacities in that realm. So the left was essentially denied generations of political leaders of the conscious effort of the state. Moreover, the American left, again, for a variety of particularly historically contingent reasons, has always focused more on domestic policy, has always been attached to labor unions, which is ironic, of course, given the fact that America governs a world-spanning empire. And it has been a failure, I think, of leftist intellectuals and leaders to not develop a more coherent foreign policy. Basically, as I understand it, at least, the left's foreign policy has been essentially negative, a critique, a very important critique. But that critique, I believe, today needs to be added to with a more positive vision of what could be done in the world, specifically specific policy proposals. And I think you're seeing people start to do that now, with my article just being one representative of a larger intellectual trend in which a bunch of left-wing thinkers, particularly younger left-wing thinkers in their 30s and early 40s, people who might be termed the generation, the 9/11 generation, who saw what the damage of American foreign policy could do, or what the damage that it could wreak, rather, are really taking on what should a left-wing foreign policy be in a world where the United States has, for example, almost 800 military bases? How do we deal with that reality?
Well, to be fair, though, and I think you implied it, that the left was really shrunk in terms of foreign policy after the FDR Truman period.
Exactly.
And it was a simple canard that Joe McCarthy hoisted, which is if you're a progressive domestically, you're therefore aiding and abetting the Soviet Empire, because of once the Soviets let off the hydrogen bomb, people got hysterical. McCarthy ginned up all of these purges, and we've had and the witch hunts, etc. So that was the period when the political left was or shrunk, and the Democrats had to prove that they were just as anti-communist as the Republicans. But that's ancient history now, and as we said earlier, you know, we don't have any real enemies. So I guess what you're trying to say is, you know, come on, let's come up with something different here, because the left is behind the eight ball in terms of narrative on foreign policy.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. I think you're right that it's ancient history, but we're still living in the world because the institutions that make American foreign policy, that govern and dictate American foreign policy, were created during that Truman moment in the late 1940s. So we have these institutions which are essentially mobilized to fight this permanent Cold War, this moment of crisis forever. And these are still the institutions that are making foreign policy. So I think the left should also begin considering how it could advance an institutional critique of American foreign policy making and develop new ways of understanding how foreign policy is made, ways that, in my opinion, would be more democratic, would be more deliberative, would be more subject to public and congressional approval and censure and things along those lines. Because even though it's ancient history, the institutions themselves are still very much with us today.
Well, one of the things that I get from all of the angry mail I get from leftists in the Susan Sarandon, Glenn Greenwald world, also the editors of the nation in having my eye on Putin, because it's obviously not in no way proven that Trump is the Manchurian candidate. But what we know so far is pretty damn alarming. And the idea that a hostile foreign power could have influenced the elections, we know that they did influence the election, but perhaps even put a president in, is so extraordinary. And I often refer to it in historical context as, if it's true, it would have been the greatest intelligence operation since the Germans put Lenin in a boxcar and sent him back to Russia in 1917. So the idea that people are in denial about these possibilities when there are so many realities about what's happening, even on an ongoing basis with Russian interference. I mean, my understanding of Putin is that he's a thug, but he's pretty smart. And he's basically saying to the Americans, as long as you are sanctioning me, I'm going to screw with you. And it seems pretty logical to me. But making excuses for him, whether you are a right-wing Republican or a left-wing Democrat, makes no sense at all.
Yeah, I would never want to defend Vladimir Putin. He's a repulsive person who has no interest in doing good for the world. The question for me, though, with the election is, I know that he tried and probably did interfere in the election, but what made Americans so amenable to the message that he was trying to get on their side? I think that's the question that I, as a leftist, find most compelling. Why were people so interested in the Putin propaganda? As someone who I study propaganda historically, oftentimes it's not very effective. The question is, why is propaganda effective when it is? And to me, for a leftist in America today, that is what I would be interested in exploring, even though, while admitting, I have no need to apologize or desire to apologize for Vladimir Putin.
But there has to be some proportionality, because so much of the reflex to be anti-Americanism is a kind of petulant, almost Oedipal anger at Uncle Sam. And the idea that you have to regurgitate all the sins of the Cold War that the U.S. committed and have this false equivalence about what the real struggle today is. It's the real struggle today is between gangster capitalism, kleptocrats, and very weak democracies. And if you're not on the side of bolstering weak democracies, then you're on the side of the gangsters who have a good chance of ruling the world.
Yeah, and I think the question comes is, how do you bolster these weak democracies? How do you increase people's power in a way that they're able to feel like enfranchised citizens of the world, where they wouldn't be fooled by for example, Russian propaganda on Facebook, that they wouldn't be set to believe such absurdities that were propagated by or with the support of the Russian government?
So just in closing then, what's your quick advice here to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez? Because, she's not necessarily going to be on the Foreign Affairs Committee, and she's got a lot on her plate. I think she's handling herself very well. She's certainly handling her critics incredibly well. So she doesn't really need a tutorial here. But just a quick last word on what the left needs in terms of a coherent foreign policy.
Yeah, I think Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is great, and I have no desire or interest in tutoring her. I would just say that I think all of our generation of left-wing political leaders needs to take foreign policy as seriously as we take domestic policy, and really develop a vision of what the left can do with the United States apparatus as it currently exists.
Well, Daniel Bessner, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Daniel Bessner, who's a professor of American foreign policy at the University of Washington's Henry M. Jackson School of International Studies and the author of Democracy in Exile, Hans Speier and the Rise of the Defense Intellectual. He has an article at the New York Times, What Does Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez Think About the South China Sea? The Rising Left Needs More Foreign Policy. Here's how it can start. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.